فاتحة. اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد وعلى آل سيدنا محمد. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم، صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. آمين. صدق الله مولانا العظيم. فاعلم أنه لا إله لا إله لا إله إلا الله 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 لا إله لا إله إلا الله إله لا إله لا إله إلا الله إله لا إله لا إله إلا الله إله لا إله إلا الله لا إله إله Thank you. السليم يا السليم يا السليم يا الله يا قائم يا قائم يا قائم يا الله يا رحيم يا رحيم يا رحيم يا رحيم يا رحيم يا رحيم يا الله يا دائم يا دائم يا دائم يا الله يا دائم يا دائم يا دائم يا الحمد لله الحمد لله الحمد لله الذي لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له له ملك له الحمد يحيي ويميت وهو على كل شيء قدير ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله وهو العلي العظيم Welcome everyone. It's beautiful afternoon. All afternoon by the seaside. We're so lucky and blessed to be here. It's quite an honor and a privilege. The topic they asked me to speak about was Dhikrullah, and some of you know more than others is Hassan al-Basra said, let those who know tell those who don't know, and he retired to take a nap. So, I could do that. Many of you are more advanced and have more skill than I, but I was asked to share something of this vast ocean of knowledge. Everyone hear me in the back? No? Uh-oh. We're counting on that. Is it the old thing? Oh. It's so high tech. Do you have any? All right. Oops. I suppose Lola and I have this in common. Huh? How's that? Hear me now? Hear me now? Yes? Better? Yeah. My voice is not too strong, but this evening. So I'm going to share with you bits and pieces, let's say, the beautiful rose garden that we call the Garden of Dhikr, the remembrance of God. Now, the first thing you notice about it is there's so many ways to do it. Isn't that wonderful? You know, you can sort of pick and choose, like among beautiful roses in a garden. And dhikr of the tongue, the vocal dhikr. There's the silent dhikr. There's a dhikr of the foot you might be interested in. Sufi dancing, dhikr of the physical, dhikr of the heart, dhikr of the spirit, really with every fiber of one's being, physical, mental, and spiritual, all the dimensions that make us human. One finds that the energy and time that one learns this skill is quite beneficial and is something for everyone. That's why it's all over the world. So some people, as we experimented with this morning in Pirzia's, was that last night, the Morakava. And this is a vocal dhikr with a little drum. Thank you, Kareem, for that Midwest vibe you've got. I like it very much. There's something about the Nile and the Missouri River we found out. It produces the same kind of rhythms. It's wonderful. And the dhikr of the hand. The dhikr of the heart. The dhikr of the blood, even. I knew an old Indian Sufi that took his pulse and used that as a rhythm for dhikr. And it's fantastic and wonderful how many multivarious in its approaches to different kind of dhikrs. Let me give you some of the more classical and yet exotic varieties of dhikr before I start to talk about what it is and what it does. So continuing with the theme of its multivarious and multidimensional activities, there is a muraqaba. We've seen that. Muraqaba is what I call a kind of eyes closed meditation. One is very quiet in a very still position with the eyes closed and observes, literally, muraqaba, the breath, for instance. And that's exactly 1,000 years ago how it was translated into classical Persian. Khoshdardam, which literally is observing the moment, observing the breath, something like that. And that's quite familiar to people, I think, that in this culture. However, there are plenty of different other sort of modes. There's what I call a sort of an eyes open dhikr, which can be done walking around or hiking like I like to do or something like that. That's called tafekkur in classical Arabic. Tafekkur is kind of an active contemplation, seeing what's around you, like sight, hearing, touch, smell, the usual outward senses of the physical world, and contemplating those as different manifestations or signs of God. It's kind of what I call active or an eyes open meditation. Many people, when they're training in this kind of active or eyes open meditation, the trainer, the murshid, the one who trains you in this, puts you out in nature, in a natural spot surrounded by the beauties of nature, and asks you to contemplate or remember the names or the different aspects of God, usually called Jamali. In its divine beauty. And that's the way you start in that type of practice. Other types or modes of, these are usually advanced practices, are muhasibah. Muhasibah is another way to do this, to remember God. And it goes like this. Usually every 24 hours, but you begin usually in a retreat situation, depends on who's training you. You sit down at the end of the day and you recollect the thoughts, words, and actions of that day. It comes from hisab, which means literally like an account book, you know. You make an account of yourself and what went on during the day. This is a wonderful practice, also advanced usually. And this is what you do when you take account of that day in thoughts, words, and deeds. See, it's kind of like a diary version of dhikr. And what you do is you recollect, it's a win-win situation. You recollect all the things that reflect the divine in your everyday life, thoughts, words, and deeds. And you say usually something like Alhamdulillah, Shukrullah, which is just thank God in plain English. And then in this recollection exercise, you might recollect all the things that didn't reflect, to put it delicately, the divine face of the beloved. And you say, you also a formula for that is something like astaghfirullah azim or something like that. And in plain English, this means God forgive me, more or less. One takes stock, literally in muhasabah, of one's daily or weekly or monthly activities, something like that. And what happens is slowly but surely the remembrance, quote unquote, of the consciousness of God extends into the fabric of one's daily life, if you see what I mean, and isn't just a recollection or an accountant type of situation. This is another way to remember God. It's not for beginners, they say. So it's another way. Other sort of exotic examples of dhikr is called dhikr mustamir or tadhakkur. These are technical terms for exotic or advanced forms of dhikr. And that is a long training, basically. Some of my students are very impatient with me. But if for one studies 4 years, in order to remember one's breath basically 24/7. When you're talking to people or driving or doing other activities, you have to start out very slow and this and with a pillow and a rug and nice Indian music. But after a while, one trains in tadhakkur to do the remembrance, usually on the breath, using a very complicated system of breathing, in order to remember God, as they say, standing, sitting, and lying down. It means in all situations of life. And that's quite a long training period and is particularly unusually difficult, I noticed, for most people. But it can be done. It can be done. People are, you know, on the keyboard or doing their daily activities, and yet they're remembering God inside their own heart. And that's called dhikr or dhikr mustamirun or tadhakkur. It's called various things. Let's see, tafakkur, tadhakkur, and muhasibah. What have I left out?
That's a good, I think, a few examples that people might not be familiar with in the different ways of remembering Allah in the advanced practices. What's this for, as my daughters used to say, you know, what are we doing this for? There is a polish for every rust, and the polish for the heart is dhikrullah, is remembrance of God. That is a hadith of Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and should be pointing the direction for anyone who wishes to begin the path of dhikr, whether silent or vocal or physical or mental. It's all doing the same thing. Every avenue or mode of implementation is polishing the heart. When usually in Sufi manuals they say this dhikr or that dhikr, they're talking about ritual or technique. That's a good place to begin. However, the actual process of polishing the heart is this. It is actually remembering God. It is actually remembering God, even for a moment. And the Sufis define this as forgetting about the self, which is quite difficult if you haven't tried it yet. In other words, remembering the self is our usual mode of operation in this world. You always remember yourself. But to actually forget the self and remember God is a quite a good working definition of dhikr. It's simple, it's direct, and we're all trying to do it, no matter what techniques we use. It actually has the same goal. Remembering God, forgetting the self. That's the trick. So we'll talk about who to remember and what to forget. And then, inshallah, by whatever means or mode of technique you want to use, we can try that for the rest of the weekend. I think remembering God is the problem. What's that like? Well, it turns out that language really gets in the way. And there's an inexplicable, overwhelming, and awesome experience that takes place when we remember God. In classical Sufi tradition, there's a few people. They only lasted till the Khajigan period, so that's most of it's been lost for 1,000 years, and I did a little project to dig it out called the 99 Names. So I want to decode the words a little bit. Who is it that we remember? Both Zalman Schachter, my old mentor, and a Cistercian monk reminded me that the word Allah is used in the church, the synagogue, as well as the mosque, and existed way, way before the mission of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So it's this ancient Semitic word that really means something. Another rabbi friend of mine wrote a wonderful book called God is a Verb. And the reason you can do that is because of the nature of this language, to decode it. In other words, moderns who speak the language have forgotten it. And people make all kinds of assumptions about it. So it's universal and ancient. What does it mean? It turns out, just to bore you with a little semantics, that all of these words come from verbs. In other words, there has to be a word that means to God, if you will. It has to be an action, an active flow, something that's not static. So it's something you do, you know? It's something you do. In the verb itself, I'm just translating it as to God. That's not very elegant, is it? I God, you God, he, she, and it's gods. I don't know whether that works. But it is a verb, and it means to do something. Something happens when you say that word. What is it? Well, in this wonderful exotic language, it embraces two core concepts. The word Allah embraces two core concepts: to do something and something else. One thing, and Pierre Zia reminded me of Pierre Shibley, Yo Qadasallah, it's to go mad. It's to go insane. It's to go nuts. The other concept, core concept, is to fall in love. In other words, not just to fall in love, but madly in love. It's to go nuts with passion. It's to go insane with desire. Somehow, that one word in ancient Semitic tied those two concepts together. Well, it's not such a stretch. You've all been 14 and in love. Just think of Romeo and Juliet, sort of to go absolutely mad with passion and desire, to go crazy with love. Topsy-turvy is one of my favorite definitions. But it's not just enough to say that God is Ma'shuq, the beloved. There must be this element of madness, irrationality in there to really capture that word. It's a nice, fat, juicy word. That's a linguistic term, you know. It has to encompass both those notions, or you just won't get it. So it's dynamic, it's verbal, and it's both passionate and insane. It's to go out of one's mind with desire. So it turns out, even in the dictionary, all those Sufis were right. All those Mejnun and Layla stories, they just said Allah originally, and they got it. That really says it all. You know, you can read about it, you know, all the drama and five acts, if you want to. But it is a code. All these words are like codes for this kind of drama, this kind of compassion, this degree, the vehemence, the heat of love is enough to drive you literally out of your mind. And I think that also Sheikh Llewellyn talked about that edge of madness also. There's an edge of madness. And there is much, much passion and drama and the heat and fire and light of love. If you just understand that much about Allah, you might not just say Allah, you might say Allah. You know, get it in there. It's like you were all 14 and in love once. You know, maybe her name was Julie or something, but you know, this is Sufism. Allah. You know, it kind of says it all. You have to have that, the heat of passion and the insanity. The insanity is so important. And when they talk about Majnun, which means, you know, he who is nuts, let's face it, you know, they're saying something. This is a manifestation of that burning, burning, deep desire that we're all born with. We're all born with that. We come out of the womb with that degree of passion, desire, craziness, and wonder. That is so important. I think that's a very important place to start. Because if you don't know who you're remembering or you're trying to remember, you know, what's the point? You see? I mean, it, for me, and I'm a native English speaker, obviously, G-O-D doesn't get it. You know, somehow, the passion, the insanity, they talk about yearning. We talked about yearning. That's a good place. Well, of course, yearning. That's all we're trying to say. I mean, yearning for Allah is kind of a tautology, isn't it? I mean, you yearn for the beloved. That's what you, the beloved, and this passion, this crazy passion, is that yearning. Now, it turns out that yearning, and we talked about yearning of the heart, yeah? Qalb. Okay. Just to give you an idea of how really sexy this language is, I don't mind telling you that. I mean, God bless those 19th century Scottish Presbyterians, you know, who translated this stuff. I mean, I know what they were probably trying to do, but I'm going to tell you the truth. You know, what they the word for himma, I was getting in trouble with talking about this stuff, but it's, hey, it's in the dictionary. It's Scholastic, don't worry. Himma, you know, that's the original word. You know, that comes from a real-life soap opera in the Quran. Actually, that word, the word the Sufis use for yearning, you know, the stories about Joseph, alayhi salam. Now, I don't know how you translate this, but if the lady of the house tricks the young servant and shuts the door and tries to tear his clothes off, I don't call that aspiration. You know, I can find that in the dictionary. It kind of leaves me cold. I mean, I know what they mean. I know what they mean. I don't know what they were trying to do. They were Scottish, German clerics. But, you know, I have a few other words I can think of to translate that. But that's exactly the word. That's the context that of the verse, you know, that the Sufis used. It's himma, you know. Okay, yearning, fine, whatever it is. But yearning for God, you see where we're going with this? It's passionate. It's crazy. She had a lot to lose, right? Like her status and Potiphar's wife. You know the whole story to go over that. But it's crazy. It's passionate and drives you, you know, to do things that you normally wouldn't do. So what we call yearning, or in the dictionary, aspiration, is really, really hot. It's a kind of burning and yearning. And it's that word that the Sufis specifically chose to describe desire for God. Desire for God. Because I'll tell you, the older I get, the more I realize, in spite of paperback books, there's very few mystics in the world. I know, it's disappointing. You know, in 1970, I thought everyone would be a mystic, but I was in Santa Cruz, you know, and everybody was pretty mystical in those days. on some kind of substances, they were all magic mushroom types. And They were all pretty, and I thought, you know, Carlos Castaneda, I thought this was it. It would be like a mystical age. But unfortunately, I find out that, you know, that yearning for the beloved, it kind of grows cold, you know. I don't know how many of you are married or have been in relationships, but kind of goes cold or kind of flattens out. But not so, it turns out, for mystics. That burning, that yearning just doesn't last a moment or a year or through youth. It burns like a very hot blue flame through one's life. And that, it turns out, that yearning of the heart for the beloved, for Allah, now you know what I mean, for Allah, really is the center of the heart. We remember the beloved with that yearning of the heart, that burning, yearning, longing, desire itself for the heart. If one is so lucky as to realize and stay in touch with this kind of desire, with this yearning, then one remembers the beloved. Then one remembers the beloved. You see? It turns out that there are very few mystics who are so blessed as to be tortured by this degree of desire. They are called the lovers. They are called Sufis. They are called the wanderers, the seekers. There's all kinds of names for them. But they all have this in common. It just won't let you alone. And so to explain this rather unusual experience, poets and mystics have used the language, which is a common experience, falling in love. That's a common human experience, to explain or to symbolize that, look, remembering Allah is something like what you've all experienced. So let's go back to love. Sing Teenagers in Love after this. It's not too traditional a Sufi song, but we can sing Teenager in Love. You know what you think about the first thing you get, you wake up when you're in love? Remember that? Pretty hot, huh? That's right. Even before you open your eyes, you think about, you're a teenager in love now. Who do you think about? That's right. Other people are thinking about their stock market reports. I hate to bum you out. You know, the weather, or their latest ailment, or something like that. Not a lover. You know that. You know a lover has other problems, you know. But love is just so great. I mean, it's burning, yearning, the first thing you think about when you wake up in the morning is Allah. That's the honest to God truth. That's how you know. That's remembrance right there. That's how you know. That's a real zikr, by the way. That's not some kind of technique that you have to do for hours and hours with beads. You know, you're just in love. You see what I mean? You get up. It's really annoying being around these people, by the way, if you're not in love. You know what I mean? It's like, you want some toast? Yes, she loves toast. She's not there, you know what I mean? She loves rye bread with pickled herring. That's an old Arabian recipe, rye bread with pickled herring, by the way. You know what I mean? That's remembrance. The bread, honestly, the bread reminds you of Allah. It's just like that. It's a common experience, but this lasts for a lifetime, like that. You go outside, you know, and every street is named Juliet Avenue. You know, like Julie, you know, we walked there. I remember when we walked there. Oh, you know, You're nuts. You're in love. Every street is like Divine Avenue. You know what I mean? Holy Alley. You know, it's like that. It's great. You're in love. Remembrance takes hold of you, and the yearning is so hard. You are everything in your life. You know, Rumi and Shams al-Tabriz must have been great. God bless them both. Did this little thing called a retreat, a khalwa. And instead of saying, I don't know, the Turks always say paneer, paneer. You know, the cheese seller in the street says cheese, cheese for sale. They were all of a sudden, he said they were saying Allah. You know, the birds saying tweet, tweet, whatever the classical Persian for tweet, tweet is. I haven't looked it up yet. They said Allah, Allah, all the birds. You see? You are in this vast ocean of love, every drop of which reminds you of the beloved. Junaid said he couldn't sleep at night. I think it was Junaid or Hatifi, because all the crickets were saying Allah, Allah, you know, and he couldn't get to sleep. He said, Allah, thank you so much for opening my heart. Now, would you close it a little bit? I'd like to get a little rest. But not so for lovers. Remember? Tears on my pillow. I can sing that song. We were talking about rock and roll. Yes. Tears on my pillow. That's a Sufi song. You know, you couldn't get to sleep at all last night. You know, that burns you. That keeps you awake at night. That occupies your heart. That's a dhikr. A dhikr is to forget about the self, even for a moment, and remember the beloved, because you are in love. You lose all sense of what's called self-awareness, and divine awareness settles in like a cool rain in the evening onto your heart. It's called sakina or shekhinah in Hebrew. It has this gentle cloud-like rain effect and just settles in on your heart and dwells there. And in that dwelling, there is a remembrance that is, mustamir, means continuous. Continuous. You're in love forever. You're in love forever. Your first love. The love you think about first thing in the morning, the love you remember the last thing in the evening, the love that keeps you awake at night. You see, that's dhikr. That's the real exercise of dhikr. Very few people start out this way, but this is the passion that we want to keep alive. The passion, you know. I hate to say this, but I've been an imam for almost 40 years. I sound like one of those old guys, you know? And I've seen a lot of weird stuff in my lifetime, but you know, that's the religion biz. I worked in the San Quentin prison for decades. One thing I noticed is that people go to sleep. They become passionate, you know? The passion wakes up in their heart. And they're raring to go, and they're burning with compassion, and they start all kinds of projects. But slowly, 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 they fall back to sleep. So awakening the heart is the title of this gathering. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. There's a very famous commentary on a book called The Book of Wisdom called Iqad al-Hamam. Means rekindling the yearnings. Isn't that a great title? Rekindling the turning, the yearning for God. We fall asleep. And it's a whole little textbook for mostly religious, for spiritual teachers on techniques for doing that. You want to revive or literally rekindle. Iqab is a very fancy word for rekindling. Because we know you start out with a lot of steam and slowly but surely you start to remember the self, the self, the self, the self instead of Allah. And that is a very important and I must say necessary place to be in. Believe it or not, it's part of the journey. It's called Sufi burnout. That's not a technical term. That's which is something we made up in Berkeley. Sufi burnout. It happens. I know about it. But the real physicians of the heart are called tabib al-qulub. The physicians of the heart have many, many ways. They understand this malady, burnout. And to revive or to rekindle that burning desire, just like a teenager in love, is so, so important. To keep that spark, to keep that burning alive, is really most of what these techniques are for. They really are. They're artificial, they're ritualistic and repetitive, I know, but they work. They work for many people, and there's always something, if you keep searching for that practice and stay with it among the other practices, there's always something that can rekindle that desire. We want that burning, you know? We want that insanity. We want that craziness, that edge of nuttiness and that passion. We want it. We want to keep it alive. We really do. And there are ways to do it. And just to sort of summarize, you may feel that rekindling of desire in song. You may feel it in breath. You may feel it in meditation. There's no really wrong or right way to do it. My suggestion is find the one that's right for you. Pursue that one. One thing that I'm absolutely delighted with about particularly this gathering, I think is so important, is that we visit each other in the different practices. The different strands are woven together. And coming out of this, knowing that we're all really doing the same thing in different ways, is so refreshing, isn't it? It's so refreshing. Rather than saying my group is better than yours or something like that, is that there's something that works for everybody. Sufism has been around for, you know, thousands and thousands of years, and I've met Cambodian Sufis, you know, San Jose, Vietnamese Sufis, and really Chinese Sufis, you know, where it's against the law. And I've met really people that are doing this practice all over the world, not just in California. Made me shocked to know that people do that elsewhere. But it's so refreshing to know that there's something for everyone in this vast, vast garden of dhikr. Thank you very much. Thank you so much. I just made it short. Hoping that there'd be time to answer questions. Let me, is that all right to entertain questions? Yeah. I can review those exotic terms or anything you like. There's some questions I must preview you on that I'm not going to answer, not because I don't like them. It's because I usually, some of the questions I think about for 2 years and I'll get back to you. I have that kind of mind where I don't jump to conclusions, and I take your questions very, very seriously. So, any questions on these? Yes, please.
Thank you. You can hear me. This is my first experience of sitting with or being with an imam. Thank you. I remember a photograph of a Christian minister and an imam and a rabbi walking down the street together.
Yeah, I'm in one of those groups.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if there was a little Hebrew in you. But anyway, I wanted to ask you, what is the pivot point? Was it in the love song, or was it some other experience that made this pivot for you, being an American?
Yeah.
And knowing that it was different than hanging out with your surfboard or your blades or whatever. What was the pivot point for you where you knew you were gone?
How did you know I had a surfboard? Were you there in the steamer's lane?
I heard about it.
Amazing.
You know?
Oh, you heard about it. My reputation is.
I remember a fellow telling me he wanted to get out of town, and I said, it's hard to do on a surfboard. But anyway, I'm in earnest about the question.
The pivot point.
The pivot point. Because you weren't surrounded by a community that was telling you these things.
No, I was a white kid in Southern California.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I usually don't talk about that one. Actually, that's quite a complex question. Pierre Llewellyn kind of talked about it, and it's one of those thorn patches you can get into. So, without doing too much theology, because you all fall asleep in the afternoon, it's one of the favorite, at least in Jewish, Christian, and Islamic thinking. This is one of the favorite subjects, and I'll just try to get around it. The reason people haven't figured this out is because it's not exactly logical, but in the classical way, but there is a way that explains it a little bit. And it's like from one point of view and from the other point of view. So let's take it there. If you're in a theistic universe, and I don't know if you are or not, they're sort of like your point of view and God's point of view. We can maybe take the chance of starting there. I don't know, how far you want to get into this. But look at, from your point of view, you don't know that much, right? That's so refreshing, especially for I'm supposed to be the answer man and I have this great education. But, the truth is I don't know that much about the soul. I know that's depressing. I don't have another job. I do this professionally. in five languages, and I still don't know that much. It's so great to just say that. Not because, if I studied something about the physical universe as a physicist, they'd tell you at Berkeley, they tell me they don't know that much either about the physical universe. Well, think about the soul, if it exists. It's supposed to be so much vast. Much more vast than the physical universe. So therefore, it's a humbling experience. You don't know that much. And so you try stuff. People ask me if there's any magic formulas and what path should I take and who's my teacher. This is like, stop thinking about that and get out there and do stuff. It's more verbal, like the Semitic languages. It's like try this for a while and try that. There's a great word for it. It's called, talib, a seeker of truth. It's, on the Sufi map, that's the first stage or seven stages of everything. The first stage is called seeker. You're a seeker. You just try stuff. You're searching for something you don't know that much about. You just like a stab in the dark. That's fine. And that's exactly what I was doing. I was trying stuff. I had a vague idea. I thought I'd be really smart by the time I was in my 60s. It didn't happen. But, I thought I'd know more, but I didn't know that much. And I tried stuff. You try stuff. You have the himmah. You act on it. You know, try to this method and that method, this book and that method. It's fine. It's fine. And that's exactly what I was doing. That's from your point of view as a seeker of truth. After a while, you get the sneaking suspicion that you don't run the universe after all. I know, it's so disappointing to come to that realization. You know, like in theology we have a question like, who's in charge here anyways? You know, like a badly run play. You know, who's in charge of this? Who's directing? You know, everything seems to be going wrong. You just wonder, who's in charge here anyways? And that's from God's point of view, from the director's point of view. It's a gift. I think that was said this morning. The desire, the yearning is a gift. The method is a gift. The teacher is a gift. You trying to do stuff is a gift. You get gifted. Mu'ti. Al-Mu'ti is the name of God. One who gifts. Isn't that a great word? One who gives the gift. And it is a gift, you see. I'll give you a kind of a negative viewpoint about the mechanical universe, you know. I happen to like candy bars quite a bit. Heath bars, you know. And I used to work in a factory, in a Lipton tea factory. And you put your quarter in or whatever it was and you get your candy bar like that. That's how most people look at spiritual practice. You know what I mean? It's mechanical. If I do this much stuff and go to this many workshops, you know, in Asilomar, I'll get the goods. I mean, that's what the Naf says. When am I going to get this and how much is it going to cost me? Pretty much, it's cut and dry. You know what I mean? It's a rational mind. It's like a mechanical universe. And that's why people say, well, I've been trying this practice for, you know, 6 months. It worked for a while. Now it doesn't work. The candy bar doesn't come down the chute anymore. And you're going, hey, what happened? I put my quarter in. You know, now I'm bored. Try another teacher. And some people do that for the rest of their lives. That's a possibility. I'm sorry, but, you know, it's like you go from candy machine to candy machine. I don't know how far to take that example, but in Ramadan when I fast, I really talk about candy machines a lot. You know, Snickers with the peanuts. I go, this is a great... I'm talking about theology. What's wrong? The peanuts and the... You know. There was a dervish, a poor beggar dervish, who heard about a princess. This is from a kind of a classical story. And she was a quite beautiful and thought that she was, or her father rather, thought she was too good for any man to marry. Kind of like me, I have four daughters. I know that feeling, you know. No guy is good enough for my daughters. It's natural. So he invents this awful system. He says, you know, he takes the thimble, the cup, and says, any guy that can empty the sea with this one cup gets the girl. Okay. So the usual thing is two guys try off with their heads and so and so forth. So this ragged dervish comes and starts to empty the sea. The first day, the second day, the first month, this is Hema. You know, he's doing his practice. You know, boring, boring. I'm never going to get this sea empty, et cetera, et cetera. Let's do desalinization. He thinks all kinds of things. First year, second year, third year, he gets up every morning and tries to empty the sea with this this cup right here. The morning of the third year, the princess is out airing in the sunlight and says, hey, who's that guy there? Everybody forgot about him. And the servant says, don't you remember your dad's crazy idea about trying to get you married? Whoever can empty, oh yeah, that was a dumb idea. What, he's still there? I can't believe it. So she invites, the usual, she invites him to lunch and they get married, the end of the story. Things happen fast. You know, anybody that would get up every morning for 3 years and try to empty the sea thinking about me deserves, you know, to get. So, that's what spiritual practice is. So I was emptying the sea, trying different cups and so on and so forth, not having any idea, you know, what I was doing. There was a long answer to the story. Or, you know, there was a princess. I had some idea about a princess, you know, but I don't know, you know. When you're 15, it changes a lot. I was 14. Some days I was doing my practices, some day I wasn't. But it turns out in the long run, now I can say that what's called sabr, the only qualification you need to be a student, by the way. You don't need to be good or holy or wear robes, by the way. You don't need any of that. All you need is perseverance. That's all it takes. Perseverance is the one quality a student needs to do something every day, whether it works or not. And that's what happened to me. I don't know. I can't explain anything else. I was so flighty. I didn't do anything every day. But that seemed to last. I had a sense that something was going to happen through the long and the short. You see what I mean? But I was disappointed. I met lousy teachers. I did, you know, dumb things, and I made mistakes. But I just kind of kept at sort of the basic practice, which did turn out to be a breathing practice, by the way, because I was too lazy to do anything else. So that was the pivot. It happened years later, but I think something happened at the beginning. I knew I had to keep doing it. I was just too stubborn to give up, basically. Yeah. That was 1968. Yeah. Good question. Thanks. So, anyone else? Yes, please. I'm so happy people have questions. I do tell long, long stories, but
I wonder if you would speak about the language and the syllables and why would we say Allah instead of some other word?
Yeah. I didn't hear the first part of the question. Sorry.
Would you talk to us about the language and the words and the syllables? And why would we say Allah instead of something else?
Right. I have plenty of Israeli students that do this in Hebrew. I have one Roman Catholic, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't. I'd be thrilled if people just took their own mantras or whatever they're doing and just, I mean, I'm a linguist, so it's simply a matter of language. It's simply a matter of language. Most of the books are written in either Arabic or classical Persian, so they come out that way. But if you can do this or any other practice in your own language and it means something to you, then do it. One of the dangers, I would say, as a Westerner, I would say, of a non-Western tradition is exoticism, used mainly for escape purposes. I know, it happens. Who knew? This is a danger, actually. I mean, when you're starting out, you can do all kinds of things like that. But what happens is, it's in Catholic theology, it's called acculturation. There's a tension between the culture and its and the exotic spiritual path. One of my favorites is from the Christianization of the Vikings. It's one of my hobbies. It seems normal, right, for Scandinavians to be Christian, but let me tell you something. They had a real, in their culture, they had a terrible time with the God-man. The God-man was fine. That wasn't the problem. Giving himself up to the police and letting himself be nailed to a cross. Vikings thought that this was totally wimpy. You know, those Viking warriors said, what? The hero god, like Woden, like turned himself in? You know, we Vikings don't do that, by the way. You know, we have hammers and horns on our, you know, they just couldn't get this. It's like, we're not going there. This sort of weird Middle Eastern religion, forget it. We're Vikings. You know? And what they did, it's great, you know. How they sort of softened it is, now I'm probably going to forget your question. Oh, how they softened it is the Celts, for instance, you know those Celtic crosses? They just decorated it with native designs. Oh, well, that's fine, you know. You know, they sort of, it's enculturation, it's called. And the Vikings, they have these great poems in not the early sagas, but mostly they were illiterate in Vinland or whatever it was. But the early priests wrote these poems saying, you know, sort of like onward Christian soldiers, you know, to get this wimpy thing out of the way. And these poems in Icelandic say, do you ever notice the cross really looks like a sword? And they said, oh, yeah. A sword. We can relate to a sword, you know. It's so funny, you know, how this stuff happens. So this, you know, rather exotic Middle Eastern religion, Christianity, comes up to Northern Europe, you know, and they sort of move around it. And my point is, you have to make this stuff your own. You know what I mean? I can tell you this. You have to make it not only familiar, you have to take it on your own terms. If it's a borrowing and it feels uncomfortable and weird or terroristic or whatever I'm threatening now, you know, just don't do it. You know, if you want to go, if you want to do another mantram, you know, I think that's what's so attractive about the Sufi dancing, that they do take it from all the traditions. You know, if you want to do Om Hari Rama or something like that, it's fine, whatever the words are. The other part, whatever is feeling familiar to you, do it, you see. That vicar means vicar of the beloved. The beloved isn't a priest or a rabbi or an imam. You see what I mean? It can't be that way. It has to be transcendental. It must necessarily transcend all of those formal aspects, or it won't work. You'll just put it in a box and forget about it. In the mysticism of sound and breath, however, there are certain, I don't know how detailed to get about this, there are certain mystical dynamics that work. For instance, the in-breath and the out-breath. That's normal. The in-breath and the out-breath work like this. But see, in my kind of dialect, I'm going to translate it into something I'm familiar with. You can, hopefully, the creative part will be, you'll be able to do this with whatever, you know, tradition you're in. And that's what's so wonderful about the freedom of the Sufi tradition. You can just take it and use it. But in the classical tradition, for instance, I'll just give you a couple examples. If you break up Allah into two parts, in your in-breath or out-breath, or La ilaha is one part, and illallah is the other part. So you have an in-breath and an out-breath. So the dynamic is the same. This is what happens. There is a kind of mystical balance and harmony and wholeness and healing that happens in the breath practice or the chanting. For instance, al is positive and la is negative, means no. La ilaha is called nafi, which means negative, and illallah is positive. So in the dynamics, using the classical terms in this tradition, you balance all the negatives with all the positives. You can do this with thoughts, negatives, positives, because you're breathing, right? We know you're breathing. You can do this with emotions, say anger and compassion and forgiveness. Every time, in other words, a negative emotion comes up, you say, la ilaha, you match it. It's negative. Now we know you have to breathe out. We know this. You breathe out, illallah, compassion and forgiveness. See what I mean? So the specifics of the mantra, it probably works out, I think Yerit did it in Hebrew and in Israel, they balance each other in their specifics. So we use that part of the language to achieve what's called al-mizan. It means, balance and harmony. And we do that on many, many levels. Llewellyn gave you a map of 5 or a map of 7 or whatever it is. You can do that on every level, is balance on the mental, the spiritual, and even on the physical level. You seek balance. So the meaning of the words themselves, for instance, suggest a quest for balance. So you have simply put, I covered the word Allah, right? It consists of 2 parts. Al, that's positive. La is negative. Now I'm cheating because I left off one little letter at the end. Ha. It's not Allah, it's Allah. Ha. A very nice sound. That's the transcendental or third element. The ha of who in Sufi codes ha, it stands for who. The transcendental element. That is what is beyond all positive and negative, and also embraces all positive and negative. It's called kamal. Means not a camel. It means perfection. It's a syllable of perfection. I've been doing extensive work with a very enlightened Kabbalist, a rabbi in Berkeley, and we've been doing a lot of stuff, you know, in Andalusia and Spain and so forth and so on. And apparently, this idea, even if it was translated, that idea carried into the other traditions quite well. Everybody got that one, down to Isaac Luria and other early Kabbalists who studied from Spain or were in Spain. They all could relate to what's called the mystical paradox. You know, somehow, when we're talking about the infinite, we're talking about the infinite, remember, we must include all positive and all negative.